This is The Guardian.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
The National Conservatism Conference took place this week in London, with big figures on the political right lining up to voice their thoughts.
I see no reason why every other country in the world should be prevented from feeling pride in itself because the Germans mucked up twice in a century.
They included cabinet ministers like Suella Braverman, once again seeming to position herself as the next Tory leader.
White people do not exist in a special state of sin or collective guilt.
With Rishi Sunak's government still reeling from a terrible set of local election results, that leads us on to a sobering thought. Sooner or later, might the National Conservatives end up running not just the Tory party, but the UK? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are the former Conservative Cabinet Minister David Gawke and the Chief Leader Writer for The Observer, Sonia Soda. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Today, we are going to be talking about the right of the Conservative Party, the hard right, some would say, the National Conservatism Conference that has been happening in London and what it's all about. And we will sort of zoom out from there to ask the very, very big question about what that conference and the politics it reflects tells us about where the Tories might be heading. So let's talk about the National Conservatism Conference. The darlings of the Tory right, including the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, Jacob Rees-Mogg, David Frost, Lord Frost, Lee Anderson and Michael Gove have all been speaking this week at a very, very high-profile event in Westminster called the National Conservatism Conference. It's the second time it's happened in the UK. Braverman's big speech was signed off by 10 Downing Street, reports tell us. The National Conservatism Conference and the National Conservatism Project are an offshoot of the American think tank, the Edmund Burke Foundation. The conference isn't an official Conservative Party event, but with two cabinet ministers speaking, you'd be forgiven for thinking it's a kind of major event in the Tory calendar. First question, how do you feel about it, David? As a former Conservative minister, seeing high-profile Conservatives speak at something which is quite sort of, I don't know what the word is really, sobering, mind-boggling, eye-catching?
Well, this won't surprise you, John, to say I'm not an enthusiast for national conservatism. I'm not altogether surprised that Jacob Rees-Mogg is speaking there. I don't really understand what Michael Gove is doing, involved with it. But no, it represents a particular strand of politics that was on the fringes of the Conservative Party and perhaps more often to be found outside the Conservative Party. I mean, looking at it, it feels like a UKIP event from 10 years ago. Or it feels like something from the US, or it feels like something from 50 years ago. It doesn't feel like the Conservative Party that I was part of.
Sonia, just briefly, I wonder how you feel watching it, because things have been said from time to time at this conference over the last few days, which I've thought are acutely unpleasant. You know, to call them offensive doesn't quite do them justice, actually. It's pretty horrible stuff,
yeah.
Some of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And even knowing where the right of the Conservative Party is, I suppose, I found some of what's been said quite surprising. So really, really ultra-conservative stuff, some very unpleasant anti-Semitic stuff as well. And it's so out of kilter with where the country is. I mean, I think that's the thing that that first crosses your mind when you hear this stuff, which is that, you know, it really does have the feel of a 1990s kind of back to basics, but on steroids, essentially, socially conservative agenda. And that just doesn't really feel where Britain is as a country.
1990s might be a bit generous, about 60 years before, some might say, but I'll park.
Yeah, that's a good point,
I'll park that point for now. Let's go into a few things that have been said and subjects that have been raised. It's worth noting that at Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, Angela Rayner, who was standing in for Keir Starmer, called the conference a Trump tribute act and a carnival of conspiracy. There is a sort of founding statement of national conservatism, which you can find very easily online, written by its prime movers in America. And that says that national conservatism wants a world of independent nations, society centered on the traditional family, big official role for Christianity, quote, which should be honoured by the state and other institutions, both public and private. It's also, as a sort of body of ideas, very, very worked up about immigration and this somewhat paranoid idea that immigration, along the lines that most countries experience it, somehow represents a threat to a country's very existence. Let's hear a bit of what Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, said about immigration and multiculturalism when she spoke.
It's not xenophobic to say that mass and rapid migration is unsustainable in terms of housing supply, public services, or community relations. Nor is it bigoted to say that we have too many asylum seekers in this country for whom we have insufficient accommodation. That absorbing more and more people means building more and more homes is another one of those unfashionable facts that the Open Borders Brigade would say means we're starting a culture war. It's not racist for anyone, ethnic minority or otherwise, to want to control our borders.
David, what she was expressing there is actually the sort of centre of gravity within Conservative politics now on those issues, right? It may have sounded outlandish in places, but that's the sort of government line on immigration. Certainly that one issue, isn't it?
Well, it is. At least that's the rhetoric. At the same time, the government recognises the value of immigration to our economy, and the numbers of people coming here really quite high by historic standards. In fact, very high by historic standards. And look, there is a legitimate argument to be made about you've got to have controlled immigration, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that this is being put, if you like, at the heart of what this thinking, this movement is all about, is something which I think is really quite revealing.
What does it reveal?
Well, she's Home Secretary, and the Home Secretary has responsibility for immigration. But the sense that wanting to focus on immigration as an issue, that this is the thing that can kind of bring together the 2019 Conservative coalition, I'm really sceptical that that is correct. But I can see why they're wanting to do that. They're wanting to get the people who were very excited about Brexit and wanted to get Brexit done and voted Tory in 2019 as a consequence. They're now thinking, well, Brexit isn't going to be the issue. Jeremy Corbyn isn't going to be the issue. Immigration is going to have to be the issue. So they're going to want that as a sort of big dividing line.
But they're fighting a rearguard action against reality to some extent, Sonia, aren't they? Because as we know, any time now, the latest immigration figures are going to come out and they're going to show that the idea that Brexit marked an end to immigration into Britain is for the birds. It's not happened. In fact, the reverse has happened.
No, absolutely. I think the next set of figures are going to show immigration at record high levels. And the reason for that, I mean, it's a mixed bag. It's obviously partly because of what's happened in Ukraine, partly because of refugee flows from other parts of the world. But it's partly just the economic reality, which is that we've got massive labour shortages in our economy and we're quite reliant on incoming immigration. And you've got these tensions within government where apparently for Suella Braverman, that's an issue, whereas the Treasury seem to sort of have been quietly just letting this policy kind of work its magic in terms of increased immigrants and the impact they're having on the economy.
In that sense, there is a quiet war going in.
Yes.
Going on. There's a quiet war going on within government over this issue, isn't there?
Yes, yes. I think it's quiet because clearly there is a bit of a sense that, you know, maybe this isn't Sunak's particular brand of politics, but he's certainly not stopping Suella Braverman from making it her thing, and she's very much a part of his government. So I think it is a quiet war. It's not like the Treasury are making a big song and dance about the fact that, you know, immigration numbers are going up and doing lots to celebrate them. But I think there has been a certain amount of permissiveness there because they realise that it's an economic necessity at the moment.
I mean, on the subject of economic migration, Suella Braverman said one of many mind-boggling things last week was that she wanted British people to fill the gaps in the workforce as regards picking fruit are concerned. Now, I know for a fact, if you talk to anybody involved in the business of picking fruit, they will tell you that's impossible. So not only is this rhetoric offensive, it's just completely unrealistic. And yet, she thinks that's the way that you enhance your chances of being the next Conservative leader.
And I'll tell you another area of confusion here, which is, one way, if you want to get more British people into work, one thing you could do is more support for childcare. But Jacob Rees-Mogg is standing up saying, hold on, this extra money for childcare, that's wrong.
And he said it was unconservative.
Unconservative. And I think there's, behind some of this is the sort of sense that, mother's place is at home. So the jobs are not going to be filled by immigrants and they're not going to be filled by mothers.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, we are ascertaining that this brand of National Conservatism doesn't make much sense up close, which is not that much of a surprise. Let's move on to what Danny Kruger, a former Cameron-era Conservative insider, the MP for Devizes in Wiltshire, let's hear what he said about what the Conservatives, or certainly these Conservatives, would call family values.
The normative family, held together by marriage, by mother and father sticking together for the sake of the children, and the sake of their own parents, and the sake of themselves, this is the only possible basis for a safe and successful society. Marriage is not all about you. It's not just a private arrangement. It's a public act by which you undertake to live for someone else, for their sake and the sake of your children and the sake of wider society. And wider society should recognise and reward this undertaking.
I mean, it's no surprise to hear a Conservative politician saying that necessarily. I remember the Thatcher and Major years when they were very, very hostile and offensive about single-parent families, for example. It's still here. Danny Kruger attempts to be giving it some sort of, highfalutin philosophical grounding. It doesn't detract from the fact that a lot of people will find that pretty horrible to hear.
No, totally. And I think the reason why I was still surprised was because it really did feel like the Conservative Party had genuinely moved on from some of this stuff. You know, when Theresa May said that she didn't want them to be the nasty party anymore, it was the Conservatives who brought in equal marriage. So this really is striking a note that I don't think we've heard in British politics for a good sort of 20, 25 years, which is, somehow the only type of normative family we're celebrating is the implication is one with a mother and a father, and they've got to stick together. And it doesn't matter, as I was saying earlier, if the relationship is abusive. It just doesn't seem in kilter with modern Britain. But also, if you're really interested in child outcomes and positive child outcomes, absolutely, if you've got two parents, it's positive if they stay together, if they can have a healthy, positive relationship. If it's a destructive, toxic relationship, we know it can be really, really bad for children. For example, if they're witnessing domestic abuse at home, for example, that's a really bad risk factor for poor child outcomes. So this idea that, it's something universally to be celebrated and people who don't stick together for the sake of their kids are somehow, a burden on society. I mean, it's completely and utterly out of date. And as you say, John, it's very offensive.
It wasn't the only thing Danny Kruger talked about. He told the conference that Western civilization is threatened by a new religion. A mixture of, quote, Marxism, narcissism and paganism, which he said conformed to the dystopian fantasy of John Lennon. That was a reference to Imagine, the much-loved song, which National Conservatism, it seems, takes extreme exception to. It's always a good idea not to get on the wrong side of the Beatles, in my opinion, if you're a politician. Danny Kruger also talked about the intelligentsia, the globalised elite, this is a bit Theresa May-esque, whose loyalties are to everyone and no one. And he said, let us not retreat to the southeast, to the managerial class, which some people took as a meaning, really, that despite the fact the Tories seem to be losing to the Lib Dems in places like Surrey can stuff off. David, I don't know whether you know about Danny Kruger. Tell me about him. Because he said he said a lot of very striking things at this conference.
He has said some striking things. And it struck me looking at the local election results that the Conservatives were retreating from the southeast, not retreating to the southeast. So I'm not quite sure where he's got that idea from. Look, I've known Danny, I mean, not desperately well, but I've known him for quite a long time. I mean, he has always been a high Tory romantic. I think he's always sort of liked the idea of the sort of upper class who, you know, are quite patrician and are close to the working class with their salt of the earth values, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of his view. He likes the countryside. He likes traditions. He likes, you know, old England, early Disraeli. You know, it's that type of, you know, medieval England viewed through nostalgia, a kind of slightly feudal view of the nation, to be honest. Danny is not naturally a politician of the 21st or 20th century.
Yeah, more a sort of a 15th century kind of guy.
Possibly.
Look of it.
I mean, he's not as mannered, obviously, as Jacob Rees-Mogg, but there is sort of something about Danny of a kind of high Tory romanticism that I suspect, as Sonia says, is not quite where the British public is.
Okay, we will come on to the British public in due course. It's worth pointing out that the historian David Starkey on Wednesday said at the conference, the reason that the left has such ire for the Jews is jealous. They want to replace the Holocaust with slavery in order to wield its legacy as a weapon against Western culture. Another rather offensive outburst. The National Conservatism Twitter feed tweeted that, but then it was swiftly deleted. Number 10 said Rishi Sunak would not agree with David Starkey's comments. And as regards the presence at the conference of Michael Gove and Suella Braverman, ministers will speak at a range of events, said Number 10. It's for them to decide which events they wish to speak at. Here's a question. Where does all this come from? I mean, I said a moment ago that a lot of this stuff, because I'm old enough to remember such things, doesn't feel that new. You know, a certain sort of conservative has always talked loudly about the so-called traditional family, Christianity, a belligerent kind of patriotism. Certain kind of conservative has always been hostile to immigration. In certain senses, there's a sort of strong flavour of Enoch Powell, I think, about some of this. David, as someone who spent a long time in the conservative political family, this stuff must feel familiar to you when you hear it.
Yes, it does, although the prominence now is very different from what it has been for a very long time. So there's always been a strand of that. Just as look, there is a strand of this thinking within public opinion. I would say it's a small part of public opinion and diminishing, but it's kind of always been there. I think, why is it more prominent now? It's almost as if, you know, the right of the Conservative Party has won so many battles within the party that where else does it go? You know, so, well, you know, it's got us out of the European Union, which it never thought it was going to achieve. What is there to complain about now? And also the point that they're not, you know, they don't really have anything very much to say about economics. I mean, it's quite striking listening to this conference. There's not a lot about, you know, what's the economic vision. I don't think there is a shared vision there. It is much more on culture, because that's kind of where they have to go. Look, let's not overstate this. I don't think they're about to bring down Rishi Sunak, but there's a plausible scenario where the Conservatives lose the next general election, Rishi Sunak resigns, and then there's going to be a vote amongst the membership. And in those circumstances, this movement could be influential.
That's the subject of part two. Sonia, it's worth pointing out that National Conservatism, in its specific sort of organisation, what this organisation, National Conservatism, what the project does, you know, it has bases in a few European countries. And at past conferences, speakers have included Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban in Hungary. There is a lot that it shares in common with sort of European populism, and that's putting it politely. I mean, some of the European politics I'm talking about, in my opinion, certainly blurs over into things that are inspired by pre-war fascism, if not aren't fascist themselves, right? So there's a European element to this, ironically, given the fact these people are Brexiteers.
No, there definitely is. And I think that's quite a sort of, I think it's interesting that there are elements of the Conservative Party that are looking to what's going on internationally around right populism and kind of, you know, deciding to sort of, you know, when you decide to go along to a conference like this as Home Secretary, you're making a statement. And I thought that rather anodyne statement that you read out from Number 10, where, you know, they were saying, well, it's completely up to ministers what they do. Well, that's true to some extent, but it's very rare, I think, when you're actually in government to get ministers going and speaking and sharing a platform with some people with some, you know, really quite spicy, as you alluded to, views there, John. And I think it's kind of, it would be the equivalent of, you know, coming up to 2009 in the Labour government and the Labour cabinet suddenly deciding, oh yeah, we're going to go and share a platform with Stop the War. It's sort of really on that kind of scale.
Rishi Sunak is in a very awkward position in relation to all this, isn't he? Whereby there are aspects of it that I think he'll find quite uncomfortable, not necessarily in terms of his personal views, but the sense that electorally this might be quite toxic, at the same time as he clearly is giving it space. He's, you know, Number 10 signed off Braverman's speech. The presence at this conference of Suella Braverman and Michael Gove, you know, is something that must have happened with Number 10's say-so. And certainly on immigration, what has been said at this conference chimes with government policy. His politics are sort of in here somewhere at the same time as he's got one foot outside. I'm not sure I could articulate the relationship of Rishi Sunak and his politics to this. But there's more of a connection than he would probably like people to think, David, isn't there?
Personally, I think Rishi Sunak's politics is largely motivated by his views on economics. And that's why he went into politics. I think he is more socially conservative than his predecessors. But, you know, is that the thing that really sort of drives him in the morning? No, I don't think it is. I don't think this particularly excites him. Also, in tone and temperament, this is not Rishi Sunak. But he is not in a strong enough position to be able to lay down the law. He has to kind of keep the right on side. I suspect he thinks that Suella Braverman is going to resign at some point, but he's not going to want to precipitate that. I think he's a victim of his inherent weakness. I don't think it's about a weakness of personality. It's just a weakness of his position within the Conservative Party, you know, having come to the leadership in a particularly peculiar way without the endorsement of the membership. He has to tread carefully. He picks his fights, and he doesn't pick fights on these culture issues.
We should talk a little bit about how many people out in the real world national conservatism might speak for. If you listen to someone like Lee Anderson, who's now a deputy chairman of the Conservative Party, who represents Ashfield, an old coalfield seat in the East Midlands, he would tell you that the sort of things you hear from this National Conservative Conference, perhaps not with the same vowel sounds, right, but nonetheless are the sort of things you would hear on the streets of his constituency. Now, I don't actually think that's true, but that's the way that they present this sort of politics. And that, I suppose, is an interesting question, isn't it? Is this as fringe as people like us would like to think, or does it speak for quite a few more people than that?
I think there's a bit of wishful thinking going on there. So I think if you take a particular issue like immigration, for example, and public attitudes on immigration, the salience of immigration goes up and down, and the extent to which people feel positive and negative about immigration sort of goes up and down depending on what's happening. But very little of anti-immigration sentiment, if you look at the data, if you look at detailed polling done by organisations like Hope Not Hate, is driven by fear of the other or by, you know, what might be considered to be racist sentiment. Actually, the bulk of the public are pretty pragmatic on immigration. They accept the need for it. They want us to have control over it as a country. And they accept the need, you know, that it's needed economically. And if you make the case for immigration in that sense, I think you can win it, actually, if you make it in those terms.
I mean, the other thing is that although they take against liberalism, as they would see it, as this great villain, right? In the so-called Red Wall, people live out liberalism as a matter of daily experience, right? There are lots and lots of perfectly happy single parent families who live in red wall places, you know. There are lots and lots of gay people. A lot of the things that people at this conference, or the kind of people at this conference, would tell you were indicative of a society that is going to the dogs and must somehow be rescued, are just part of people's everyday lives. And that's one of the reasons why I think this whole thing feels so awkward.
Yeah, I think in a way it's almost sort of worth disentangling some of the issues. So they're trying to do the whole faith, family and flag agenda.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, that doesn't work. There are particular issues where the public is probably more socially conservative than most politicians, including quite a lot of conservative politicians. I take Sonia's point on immigration. It's a little bit more complicated than it first appears. But, you know, you look at the polling on, say, the small boats.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of the public are absolutely behind the government on that. If you look at things like crime and punishment, you know, quite a lot of the public would be much harder, much tougher than any of the political parties.
But as Sonia has said, nonetheless, if you presented the issue of immigration to the public as something that threatens our most basic sort of moral fibre as a country, which is the kind of rhetoric you hear from people like this, that would sound like fanaticism.
Yeah,
the vast majority of people. And similarly, if you said that the key to restoring British society and its sort of well-being and health was the traditional family, and we have to get back to a man and a woman and they must stay together for life and all that, again, people would think, quite rightly in my opinion, they were listening to something quite strange. That remains the case.
That I agree with that. I think there's sort of three problems with it as an agenda. One is there are other parts of it that don't excite people. So all the kind of religious stuff, that doesn't work. Secondly, how salient is this? So we can kind of talk about, you know, immigration and so on, but actually what is probably going to matter at the next general election is living standards and public services and so on. And then the third point is your point, John, which is people might hold certain views, but they might also be suspicious of politicians who actually share the same views, but they still come across as being a bit odd and fanatical. And, you know, this is something that I think the Conservative Party found in opposition after 97, is that, you know, when Conservatives said, well, we think this, the public seemed to agree. But then when the public heard Conservatives say it, they thought, well, this is a bit odd. You know, we don't expect you to agree with us. So it doesn't, I don't think it works.
Finally, it's worth pointing out that when Michael Gove pitched up at the National Conservatism Conference, he sort of gently read them the riot act, didn't he? In the sense that he said that so-called culture war issues were not really going to help the Conservatives out electorally, and the centre ground remains defined largely by economics and the state of public services, which is not what any of those people gathered there, or hardly any of them, wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's happens to be absolutely right, which is that the next election is going to be about the economy. So there is this wing of the Conservative Party that will do anything to try and drag it away from the economy, because that is not looking like it's going to go too well for the Conservatives at the election. And parties do this. When they lose a general election, they sort of tend to retract into themselves and become more radical and more extreme. It's because they've got a smaller parliamentary party. You know, it tends to be people who are a bit more adherent to the sort of core of, you know, the party's quite radical sort of underpinnings, I suppose. But that normally happens after a general election.
Yeah.
But we are literally seeing this happen before the Conservatives have even lost.
Amazing.
And I think it's
amazing,
partly because it's been such a torrid time. There have been so many changes in leadership. And, you know, some people in the Conservative Party, I think, look at Rishi Sunak and think, well, this isn't a platform that I was voted on, you know, on in 2019. And, you know, here's an opportunity to try and drag the Tory party my way. But it really is quite extraordinary to watch, given that they're still in government.
Yeah, completely. We will pause for a moment, and when we come back, we're going to look at the prospect of Suella Braverman, who we have mentioned endlessly over the last 15 or 20 minutes, becoming Tory leader and perhaps Prime Minister.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Welcome back. there are lots of people that one can speak to now who say that should Rishi Sunak fail to turn around the Conservative Party's pretty abysmal performance in the recent local elections and lose the next election, the next leader of the Conservative Party is likely to be either Suella Braverman or Kemi Badenoch. In other words, the kind of politics we've heard this week, notwithstanding its eccentricity, offensiveness and all-round rumness, stands a very good chance of taking over the Conservative Party. I mean, Suella Braverman is clearly on manoeuvres. She's not making long speeches at events like this for nothing, right? And the sort of views that she has expressed and other people express at events like this plays very well, it seems to me, with a large share of what remains of the Conservative Party membership. And they're the people who'll decide.
Yes, I'm afraid you're right on all those points. I mean, she's clearly on manoeuvres. And I mean, it is quite remarkable how blatantly she is doing that whilst being a cabinet minister. But it is worth remembering, she announced that she thought Boris Johnson should go and that she was going to run for the leadership while she was still a serving minister. So she's pretty sort of shameless. I mean, I think it's possible for Rishi Sunak to hold on if there's a narrow defeat at the next general election, because he would have clearly done remarkably well to have got it to a narrow defeat. But if it's anything worse than that, it's hard to see how he stays on. Suella Braverman has got a very good chance, I would have thought, of being the two names that go forward to the party membership. And unless something fairly dramatic happens between now and then, she's got a very, very good chance of winning that.
And that, as you said a moment ago, Sonia, will go with the grain of what we traditionally expect parties that lose elections to do. It's actually quite rare that they rationally take stock and think, well, why did we lose? Why don't people like us? Very often they double down on the selfsame reasons that they lost, right? And in that sense, that enhances Braverman's chances, let's be honest.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think it does. And there's a couple of things that contribute to that dynamic. So back when MPs used to have most of the say in both parties, actually, in selecting leaders in opposition, you used to have parliamentary parties after a general election defeat that were smaller in number and therefore would be to the left or to the right of where the party was, where it was in government, in parliament. Now, I think you've got members selecting leaders and that contributes to that trend even more. So that happened in the Labour Party post Ed Miliband. It's now a feature of Conservative Party leadership elections as well, where two candidates go forward to the members. It gives the members a huge amount of power, and members tend to be to the left and to the right of even where a post-election defeat parliamentary party is.
There's an interesting question here, which is that, I mean, Kemi Badenoch's politics are different from Suella Braverman's in the sense that Kemi Badenoch is more sort of libertarian and more kind of free, classically free market in her outlook. But on the so-called culture wars, nonetheless, there is something of an intersection, quite a substantial intersection between them. I mean, that's certainly the image that Kemi Badenoch presented in the last Tory leadership election, right? So on that basis, whatever happens, the Tory party will stay well right of centre and is likely to move even further to the right. And that brings me to a question, which is the question of whether we see any sign of a pushback against that, right? Traditionally, if a party was moving in a certain political direction, because the two main parties at Westminster are coalitions of views, you would expect a very clear alternative to arise to that. Even if it was going to lose, you would expect some opposition to be voiced. And I don't see it in the Conservative Party. Do you, David?
No, not very strongly. Most of those who would have been providing that pushback are now doing other things and, you know, appearing on Guardian podcasts and stuff like that. Rather than
you shouldn't be here. I agree.
That's a direct consequence of Brexit, right? So lots of very sensible MPs were driven out of the party by Brexit. It has left the Conservative Party in a worse place, I think.
Well, definitely the balance. I mean, of course, I'm going to agree with you that the absence of people like me, that's what's really wrong with the Conservative Party. But clearly, the balance of the party has changed. Also, the party membership is very strong. There are some sort of notable exceptions. There are people like Caroline Noakes and Tobias Elwood, who are sort of pretty brave, but, you know, my goodness, they have to put the sort of tin hat on. But yeah, there's a real problem for Conservatives to do that. But there's a gaping hole, I think, in British politics of that sort of more liberal-minded, yes, centre-right, but a liberal centre-right viewpoint. And the Conservative Party doesn't really represent that. Some of it is a little bit muted at the moment because I think most on the kind of liberal centre-right view says, look, Rishi Sunak is as good as we're going to get for a while. Let's not make waves. Let's not make his job any more difficult than it already is. And just try to help him do as well as possible at the next general election. So I think that's the thinking at the moment. But if he goes, then, you know, really it has to be gloves off for the fight of the soul of the Conservative Party. And I'm not very optimistic, but, you know, at that point, you know, if you're not making a stand then you just might as well give up.
That's fascinating. So you think come the next Conservative leadership election, which, let's be honest, is likely to happen after an election defeat next year, that will be the last chance really to arrest this passage to the hard political right. And in all likelihood, let's be honest, that attempt won't work. And the Conservative Party for a long time will be locked into a politics that you find pretty distasteful. That's what's going to happen.
I think that's probably right. I mean, nothing is forever. And yeah, there were people who said, oh, the Labour Party was lost under Corbyn and it moved relatively quickly. But yeah, I mean, the Conservative Party has been on a trajectory for some time. And if it moves to the right, you know, next time round, even further to the right, it's quite hard to see, you know, what point does it come back without at least one more crushing election defeat.
I know Angela Rayner at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday did make reference to the National Conservatism Conference. But the Conservative Party endlessly beats up the Labour Party about the elements of the Labour Party that are supposedly extreme, right? They still cite Jeremy Corbyn as an attack line against Starmer. But I haven't heard Starmer say to Rishi Sunak yet, look what you are incubating in your party. Look how horrible these very visible elements of modern conservatism have become. Do you think that's strange, David? It does seem a bit mystifying to me.
Well, I wonder whether that is because Keir Starmer is very focused on the red wall. And that actually some of the attitudes there might be quite popular amongst people he's trying to win back to the Labour Party.
You know, but I feel there's a moral duty on a mainstream politician this stuff out.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that. But if you ask after an explanation as to why Keir Starmer doesn't really go on this, it's because he doesn't want to fight on cultural grounds. He wants to talk about living standards, public services and so on.
Someone in mainstream politics, though, Sonia, has to do it, don't they? I mean, this stuff does need calling out.
Well, I absolutely agree with you on stuff like immigration. The tricky thing is that it's, as David says, Labour absolutely wants the next election to be about the economy and public services. And I guess there is a risk that if you start responding to this stuff directly, that's what comes to dominate our politics instead. And it's trickier territory for Labour.
Yeah, but also if you don't call it out, it becomes normalised. It becomes part of the discourse.
Well, yes. I do tend to agree with you on that. Although I also think that there's an argument that some of this stuff is just so kind of awful and beyond the pale, and it gets an audience on Twitter. But, you know, do we really need this dominating Prime Minister's Question, say, or like mainstream news bulletins? I mean, you can argue, well, the fact that it's being talked about at this conference means that it will be sort of piercing public perceptions to some extent. But I still think most people in the country wouldn't have a clue about this conference or the fact that it's happening.
Let us hope. And let's hope a few of them tune in to this podcast and perhaps find out just how awful it is. And on that note of qualified optimism, we will bring things to a close. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts, and even better, leave us a review. One more thing before you go. If you subscribe to our newspapers today, that's the print product, you can save up to 50%. Enjoy reading our award-winning newspapers and magazines every week. The offer ends on Sunday, the 21st of May, 2023. You can search Guardian Newspaper Subscription to subscribe today. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A third of students are less than happy about their university choice, new research by EY has revealed. The findings suggest that a digital rethink is essential to meet the expectations of students and staff. Universities can address this by putting the needs of the people they serve at the heart of their digital strategies. Learn more about the future of human-centered higher education at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.